at best, especially since they were left by a so-called berserk killer. My client's semen was clearly planted, so were the vodka, the meth, and the ID. My niece turned to face the bench. In short, Judge Varney, the state no longer has a viable case against my client. I move for mistrial and release of Stephen Tate from custody immediately. The courtroom exploded. Stephen rocked back in his chair, looking toward the heavens and hugging himself. Aunt Hattie started cheering and clapping. Pinky, Nana Mama, and I joined her. Judge Varney looked panicked when he whacked his gavel and called for order in his courtroom. Bree tapped my elbow and held her iPhone in front of me, showing me riderless boxcars going through one of the railroad crossings south of Starksville. Then she showed me a picture of the same containers going through the crossing on the main Starksville road. Two riders were aboard. "What?" I began. Delilah Strong cried, "Judge! There remains other compelling evidence that links Mr. Tate to this murder." Naomi said, "Judge, it's clear now that someone else killed Rashawn Turnbull and framed my client for the crime." "The defense offers no evidence of that at all," Strong said. "Who does she think killed that boy?" "That's really not our concern," Naomi said. "But we have a theory." "Alex, you have to see this," Bree said, shoving the iPhone in front of me again. I glanced at the screen, saw a satellite view of train tracks by an industrial complex. I held up my index finger and then looked back to Naomi. My niece glanced at me, and I nodded. She said, "Judge, we have evidence that the meth planted in Mr. Tate's basement is tied to a drug ring using the trains that pass through Starksville to distribute methamphetamine and other drugs up and down the East Coast. My client had growing suspicions about the freight trains, and we believe the drug traffickers killed Rashawn and framed my client for the murder to keep him from digging further." "This is ridiculous," Strong said. "The defense has introduced no evidence of any such drug ring. Judge, you can't..." The rear doors to the courtroom were flung open with a bang. Strong, Naomi, Judge Varney, the bailiff, the clerk, and many of the jurors gaped in disbelief and fear. I twisted around in my seat to see what they were gawking at and got the shock of my life. Palm Beach County's Detective Sergeant Peter Drummond looked like he was out for blood as he pressed the muzzle of a sawed-off pump-action Remington 12 gauge to the side of Marvin Bell's head. Chapter 96. "Nobody moves, or this man dies," Detective Sergeant Drummond roared, and he jerked at the rope he had tied around Bell's neck and hands, which were horribly swollen and bruised. Several of Bell's fingers pointed in directions they shouldn't. Spectators began to cry, panic, and push back toward the walls. Nana Mama squealed in fear beside me, and I held up an arm to shield her. Bree started for her backup pistol, but I said, "Don't. I know this guy." Drummond shouted, "Unload your gun there, bailiff, and put it on the floor. You, in the witness box, same." Frost and the bailiff did as they were told. Drummond scanned the room for threats, said, "You too, Chief Sherman, and you, Detective Carmichael. Primary weapons and backups on the floor." Sherman and Carmichael seemed shocked that the madman knew their names, but they did as they were told. Then Drummond marched Bell deeper into the courtroom. Marvin Bell looked more lost than frightened, shuffling forward, staring at his hands and quivering in pain. As they got close, I stood up, said, "Sergeant, what are you doing?" Drummond turned his scarred, expressionless face past Bree and toward me, said, "Something I should have done a long time ago." "Come on, Drummond. You don't want to do this." "You don't understand, Dr. Cross. I have to do this." The sergeant pushed and dragged Bell into the well of the court. He glanced at Strong and Naomi, said, "Take a seat, counselors." Then he motioned for Frost to get down, said, This man wants to testify. The detective hesitated, but then climbed from the witness stand. Drummond said, "Sit there on the floor by the jury box." Frost did as he was told. The sergeant maneuvered Marvin Bell into the chair and got behind him, keeping the gun at his head and dropping the rope so it dangled off the back of the chair. "Sergeant, whoever you are," Judge Varney began, "and whatever problem you might have with Mr. Bell, this is not the way to address the—" "With all due respect, Judge," Drummond said, "we are no longer in the court of law. This is truth-seeking where the ends justify the means." Beside me, Bree typed on her phone and then held it up. I realized she was filming him. I looked over my shoulder and saw that Patty Converse and Pinky Parks had gone wide-eyed. "What do we do?" Pinky mouthed. "Not a thing," I whispered, and looked at my aunts, who were sitting forward in their chairs and raptly watching Drummond. The sergeant peered around the courtroom as if he owned it, then focused on the jury box, said, "Wouldn't you just like to know what happened for once? No BS. The whole thing, out in the open, for you to judge." Despite their collective fear, several jury members nodded. "I would too," Nana Mama whispered. "You know him, Alex?" "Met him in Florida," I whispered. "He's a cop." "What happened to his face?" "First Gulf War." I knew the source of the scarring, but what had happened to Drummond in the few days since I'd seen him? Why in God's name would he do something this rash? Destroy his career and reputation? His life? I'd talked to Drummond about Marvin Bell, and how frustrated I was, and not being able to link him to the web of secrets we'd been uncovering in Starksville. And the sergeant had asked me about Bell several times. He'd done it on the phone that very morning. Drummond had obviously been close by when he called me, and Bell had never left the area. The sergeant had been holding him hostage somewhere, torturing him into a confession. But why? "We'll start at the beginning, Marvin. Way back more than 35 years, Drummond said. "You sold drugs in Starksville then, built a nice little business out of it, didn't you?"
"No,"
Marvin Bell said, sounding bewildered.
"I..."
From out of nowhere, Drummond pulled out a small ball-peen hammer. He snapped it forward with power, speed, and accuracy. The round head of the hammer smashed into Bell's swollen left hand, and he howled in agony. "Try again, Marvin," Drummond said, waving the hammer in Bell's peripheral vision. "You sold drugs. You built a gang."
"Yes,"
Marvin Bell whimpered.
"I sold drugs. I built a gang."
"Here in Starksville?"
"Yes."
"Name of that gang?"
"The company."
There it is, I thought. Bell started the company. "He's grandfather." Drummond said, "You had a ruthless business model, Marvin. Got people addicted on freebies until they were like your slaves. You had people killed. You killed people yourself."
"I never killed anyone,"
Marvin Bell said, crying.
"I keep telling you that and you don't believe me."
Chapter 97. "I don't believe you," Drummond said, wagging the hammer. "But we'll come back to that. You admit you made a lot of money dealing drugs." Marvin Bell looked from his hands to the hammer and nodded sullenly. "You laundered that money in legitimate businesses all around Starksville," Drummond went on. Looking as if his world was ending, Bell said,
"Yeah."
"But even after you'd bought the legit businesses, you didn't stay away from the drug trade, did you?" Bell set his jaw as if he were going to argue, but then he shook his head. "Course not," the sergeant said. "Moving coke and heroin and meth was just too lucrative. The money was almost too easy if you were smart about it. So one day, You noticed the freight trains going back and forth all day and all night through Starksville and thought, why not use them? Why not expand? Am I summarizing your personal history correctly? Bell tried to move his hands and gasped before nodding. Yes, Drummond said. You built a distribution network that stretches from Montreal to Miami? Again, Bell said.
Yes.
And with all that money, you bought yourself an estate up on Pleasant Lake, a gorgeous beachfront place down on Hilton Head, and a condo in Aspen, trips all over the world, art collector. Isn't that right? He nodded. Got your adopted son, Finn Davis, involved, too. Bell swallowed, said.
Finn's part of it.
Finn kill his ex-wife? Drummond asked. Sidney Fox? I heard a creak behind me as Pinky sat forward. Marvin Bell looked around the room as if desperate for someone to rescue him. Drummond lashed out again with the hammer, hit Bell's right hand. Bell let out a scream that shook everyone in the room except Drummond, who seemed calm, clinical. Answer the question, Marvin, the sergeant said. Did Finn Davis shoot Sidney Fox?
Yes,
Bell moaned. Fucking knew it, Pinky said, and he smacked his fist in his palm. That son of a bitch! Why did he kill her? Drummond asked.
Because he hated her, and she needed killing.
Why does Sidney Fox need killing?
Having been married to Finn, she suspected too much,
Bell said.
And she was talking to Tate, who was poking around the train tracks. It was all no good, so he killed her.
Drummond asked, did Sidney Fox know about your supplier? Marvin Bell groaned and shifted in his chair, said,
no.
Your distribution system got so big, you were having trouble getting supply, especially methamphetamine, correct? Drummond flipped the hammer in the air and caught it. Marvin Bell flinched, said,
yes.
So you found a secret partner right here in Starksville who could manufacture meth for you. In fact, a partner who could provide you with an almost unlimited supply and never get caught, right? A secret partner, I thought. I called it, Bree whispered, lowering her iPhone and pumping her fist. Called what? I said. Before she could answer, Drummond said, is that correct, Marvin?
Yes, I had a partner.
Judge Varney had broken out in a sweat and looked agitated, and I feared he was about to keel over again from kidney stone pain. Drummond said, you and your partner, you didn't like Stephen Tate sneaking around, looking into things by the tracks, did you?
No.
You and your partner decided that Stephen Tate had to go. Marvin Bell moved his hands, winced, said,
I agreed Tate had to go, but I had no idea what he had in mind. No idea that he'd do all that to the boy.
You know for a fact your partner killed Rashawn Turnbull? Bell looked out into the spectators and seemed to be speaking directly to C.C. Turnbull.
I know for a fact he killed Rashawn and framed Tate. He told me so himself afterward.
What did your partner say? Drummond said. Word for word. Bell swallowed and replied.
He said he'd gotten rid of two problems at the same time. Stephen Tate and his black bastard grandson.
Chapter 98. For 2 seconds, the silence in that courtroom was so deep and complete you could have heard a mouse in the walls. I was tired, wrung out. It took me a full 2 seconds to figure out the killer. And then I twisted around, looking for Harold Kane, Rashawn's grandfather, owner of a fertilizer company, chemist, no doubt. Racist? Grandfather? Kane's expression seemed electrified by the charge. His body had gone rigid, his lips were peeled back, and he was clinging so hard to the bench in front of him that I thought his fingers might snap like bells. Kane's wife stared at him, like he was something unthinkable, and cowered from his side. Kane noticed, turned his head to her, said,
It's not true, Virginia. He's...
It is true, Cece Turnbull screeched. Kane's daughter had twisted around and was looking past Anne and Sharon Lawrence to face her father, two rows back. You always hated Rashawn. You always hated that a nigger fucked your lily-white southern daughter and left you with a living, breathing tarnish on the Kane family name.
No, that's not true.
Cece went over the back of her bench then, stepped up next to Anne Lawrence, and launched herself at her father. She crashed into him, slapping and scratching at his face. You treated my boy worse than dirt his entire life, she screamed. And you stole my Lizzie. Rashawn had as much of your precious blood as my Lizzie, and you cut it out of him with a pruning saw. Bree jumped up and went to Cece, who'd broken down sobbing, as she feebly tried to continue her assault on her father. Bree pulled Cece off and held her while Kane slumped there, chest heaving, blood oozing from those scratches, looking around like a cornered animal at all the people in the courtroom watching him.
None of it's true,
Kane told them in a hoarse whisper.
None of it. It's all true,
Bell shouted from the witness stand.
You sick fuck. You deserve to burn in hell for what you did.
The courtroom doors were flung open again. Two men and a woman, all wearing business suits, came in, carrying pistols and badges. The woman said, My name is Carol Wolf, FBI special agent in charge of the Winston-Salem office. Put the gun down, Sergeant Drummond. Drummond kept the shotgun to the back of Bell's head, said, I'm not quite done yet, Agent Wolf. Mr. Bell here has one more thing to get off his chest. Chapter 99. Marvin Bell seemed genuinely puzzled, said,
I told you everything.
Not all of it, Drummond said. You said you'd never murdered anyone in your life.
That's a fact.
Never smothered anyone? A woman, maybe, Drummond said. 35 years ago?
No.
You were her drug dealer, the sergeant insisted. She was dying of cancer, and no one was paying you for the heroin her husband was using to ease her pain. Bell shook his head. You got her husband damn near overdose high on smack, Drummond said, and then you smothered her with a pillow while he watched. So numb he couldn't stop you. Drummond was breathing hard. He said, Then for almost a year, you made him work for you. And finally, when he was no use to you anymore, you tied that man to your car with a rope just like the one around your neck here. And you dragged that poor bastard through the streets, called him a wife killer, a mother killer. You alerted the police, said he'd murdered his wife, and gave him to the young men who were already in your pocket. Officer Randy Sherman and Deputy Nathan Bean. You paid them to make it look like he tried to escape. Judge Varney, a young assistant district attorney at the time, was there too. They pushed that man to the railing, and he didn't understand why they went back to the cruisers and then turned and pulled their guns. Then they shot him, and he fell off the bridge and into the gorge. Isn't that the way it happened, Marvin? Drummond had dropped the hammer and was holding the shotgun against Bell's head so hard his hands were shaking.
Yes, yes,
Bell whined.
That's what happened.
Judge Varney pounded with his gavel. That is not true. Police Chief Sherman was on his feet, about to protest, but the FBI agent said, Chief, you're under arrest, and you too, Judge Varney. I don't remember getting on my feet, only that I was. Suddenly, and staring across the courtroom at Drummond, as if down a vast tunnel of time, Who are you, Sergeant? I said, realizing that Nana Mama was standing up beside me. How do you know all these things? Tears streamed down Drummond's expressionless face as he withdrew the shotgun barrel from Bell's head and looked toward me and my grandmother. I know these things, Alex, he choked out, because in another lifetime, my name was Jason Cross. Chapter 100. Nana Mama gasped, reached for her heart, and toppled against me. Her frail, 90-pound body almost bowled me off my own liquid feet. I had to take my eyes off Drummond to regain my balance and hold her up. "Is it true?" my grandmother whispered into my chest, as if she couldn't bear to look Drummond's way.
"That's impossible,"
Bill said, craning his neck to look at Drummond.
"Jason Cross took a bullet, went into the gorge. He never came out."
"Yes, he did," said Pinky, who'd also gotten to his feet. "My Uncle Clifford found him down on the river that night, nursed him back to health." "Is Clifford here in Starksville?" Drummond called to Pinky. "I would sure like to see the second best friend I've ever had. Maybe take him to Bourbon Street like we always talked about." "Oh, my God," my Aunt Hattie gasped. "It's a miracle," my Aunt Connie cried. I looked down at Nana Mama, saw my grandmother dissolving through sheets of tears. "It's him," I whispered. "I don't know how, but it's him." When I looked up, Drummond had left Bell in the witness stand, handed the shotgun to Detective Frost, and was coming toward us with tears streaming down his blank face and his arms cast open. "You don't know how much I missed the both of you," he said. "You have no idea of the loneliness without you." I slid into my father's arms and he slid into his mother's, as if they were the most natural and familiar acts possible. We bowed our heads into one another, suddenly apart from everyone else in that courtroom, like a miniature universe unto ourselves. I don't think any of us managed to utter an intelligible word in those first few moments of reunion, but I know we were communicating deeply in a whole other language, like people embraced by holy spirits and speaking in tongues of fire. Chapter 101. 2 weeks and 2 days after we'd arrived in Starksville on a warm, clear Saturday afternoon, we had ourselves a proper reunion in Aunt Hattie's backyard. Everybody who mattered to me in life was there. Damon had flown into Winston-Salem the day before to meet his grandfather, which had been as emotional and satisfying as every other moment of my dad's return to my life. Naomi's mother, Scylla, and my brother Charlie had come in the day before that. At first, Charlie had not believed Nana Mama and me when we called him with the news. Then he'd gotten angry and said he wasn't interested in meeting someone who'd cut out on us 35 years before. But Scylla and Naomi had insisted, and when Charlie laid eyes on our dad, all had been forgiven. The only thing that would have made it better was having my late brothers Blake and Aaron there too, and we all shed tears over those tragedies. My best friend, John Sampson, and his wife Billy had come in that morning. Sampson and my dad had hit it off immediately, and when Drummond wasn't sitting by my Uncle Cliff, he and John were trading cop stories and laughing. Stephen Tate was there with his fiancée, Patty Converse, the two of them looking as in love as any couple I'd ever seen. Special Agent Wolf was there as well. Evidently, the FBI had been looking at Starksville with suspicions of judicial and police misconduct long before my father called Wolf and told her to come listen to the shocking testimony about to come out in their courtroom of Erasmus P. Varney. I went over to Agent Wolf, said, "What do you think my dad's chances are?" Wolf said, "Well, he's not going back to his job with the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office. They've been pretty clear on that. But I don't think he'll end up being prosecuted for taking Bell hostage and marching him into court." "You don't think?" I asked. "Pretty extreme move." "It was," she said. "But we arrested the police chief and the presiding judge in Star County, and the sheriff's been murdered, and Guy Petalini regained consciousness and spilled everything on all of them. The DA's office is even under investigation. Basically, there's no one left in Starksville to go after your dad, and I don't know what federal statute would apply." "So he walks free into a new life?" I said. "He walks free into an old life," Bree said, coming up beside me. "And Marvin Bell and Harold Kane go down for so many things," Wolf said. If they are not given the death penalty, which I think is the appropriate punishment, they'll at least never see the outside of a prison. I thought about Harold Kane, his callous, cruel indifference. We'd gotten more of the story from Cece. After Rashawn's birth, her parents had all but disowned her. Then Cece got pregnant by a white boyfriend she picked up while Rashawn's father was doing time. Her parents found out, and they also found out that Cece was on drugs while she was with child. The Canes used the rigged courts of Starksville against Cece and had the baby girl, Lizzie, taken from her mother's arms within minutes of birth. The courts awarded Lizzie's grandparents full custody, and they had greatly limited Cece's involvement in her daughter's life. Harold Kane had evidently spent years bitter and humiliated about his mixed-race grandson, while at the same time doting on his lily-white granddaughter and running a meth business from secret underground labs beneath his fertilizer factory. The most terrible thing about it all was that the frenzied nature of the wounds Rashawn had suffered before death clearly indicated that Kane had enjoyed killing his grandson. He'd enjoyed murdering his own flesh and blood. When it came right down to it, that poor, innocent boy had been tortured and slain for the color of his skin. I had heard too many variations of that story over the years. Young black boy killed for his race. But this one was the worst, the cruelest, the most heinous, the most sadistic, the least understandable. Like Cece Turnbull, I would never get over Rashawn's death. Kane had lawyered up and wasn't talking. Marvin Bell was talking to prosecutors who were going after Kane for murder, kidnapping, and depraved indifference within the course of a race-based incident. I hoped that whatever the jury decided about Kane, they'd make him suffer. I spotted a middle-aged woman wearing a Domino's hat coming around the corner, carrying two pizzas. Wolf, Bree, and I immediately went on alert. Varney, Bell, and Sherman had continued to turn over evidence against Kane, and they'd all stated that he had hired a female assassin known as the Lace Maker to kill members of my family and make it look like accidents. She'd missed getting Bree and me with the broken brake line. Now that Kane was behind bars, there was no reason to think the Lace Maker was still around. But you never knew. "Can I take those off your hands?" I asked the woman. "Please," she said as she smiled and handed them to me. "I'm a little late, so it'll be $5 off." "Who ordered them?" Bree asked. "Connie Lou." "Oh, Edith, there you are," my aunt said, hustling over with the cash. They hugged, and Bree and I relaxed. Then I saw something that warmed my heart. Cece Turnbull came into the backyard with a beautiful little girl who was the spitting image of her mother. And Cece looked clean and sober and thrilled to be with her daughter. Bree went into the house for something to drink. I got in line for food, with my plate loaded with fried rabbit, coleslaw, broccoli salad, and little roasted red potatoes. I spotted Pinky talking to Bree and started over. "You didn't eat all the rabbit, did you, Dad?" Janny asked from a lawn chair between Damon and Ali. "God, it's really good," Damon said. "There better be seconds." "I want some more, too," Ali said. "But Pinky said he'd cook the bass I caught yesterday up at the lake." "I'm sure he hasn't forgotten," I said. "But I'll remind him." Janny said, "Coach Green and Coach Fall said that they were going to try to come by later." "Looking forward to seeing them," I said. "But I want you to keep your options open, young lady, okay?" "Yeah, for real, Janny," Damon said. "If you have Duke already at your door, you know there's going to be a whole lot more." Janny nodded and then sobered. "Sharon and her mom going to jail?" "They're turning evidence against Marvin Bell, but even if they convince a jury that he forced them into lying about the rape, planting Stefan's DNA, and putting the drugs in your bag, I still think they're both looking at convictions and sentences." "I don't want it to, like, completely ruin their lives," Janny said. "Neither do I said. "Have fun."
"Always,"
Ali said. I grinned.
"You do, don't you? Like Jim Shockey, life's an adventure."
Feeling like my youngest had an understanding of life far beyond his years, I walked over to Pinky and Bree.
"Give me some rabbit so I don't have to stand in line," Bree said, looking hungrily at my plate. Not a chance, I said.
What? She said, miffed, after how hard and ingeniously I worked on behalf of your cousin.
Okay, I said. Take the thigh there.
Bree snatched it off the plate.
What about me? Pinky said.
You're able-bodied enough to work on oil rigs, I said.
Get in line.
My cousin laughed and went off toward the food. Bree took two bites of the rabbit and looked like she was in heaven. I had it figured out, you know, about Kane. Well, everything except Rashawn.
I believe you.
I did. That satellite photo she'd shown me in court was of Kane Industries, which sat by the tracks between the Starksville Road and the crossing 3 miles to the south. Bree had figured out from the trail cam photographs that the riders were boarding between those two crossings. She'd called up Google Earth, saw the rail line spur that ran out of Kane's business, and thought, what a great cover for a meth manufacturing op. Bree said, if your dad hadn't gone Rambo, I would have pinned Kane to the wall.
Yes, you would have, I said.
And for that, I think you've earned some downtime in Jamaica.
Bree perked up. Really?
Why not?
Just us?
Why not?
When?
Soon as you want.
God, I love the way you think sometimes, she said, and she kissed me.
Get a room, you two, Nana Mama cracked as she eased into a lawn chair near us.
We were talking about doing just that, I said.
TMI, as Janny says, my grandmother said, and she waved us off.
You happy you came back to Starksville, Nana?
Bree asked.
I'd be some kind of ungrateful wretch if I wasn't, Nana Mama said. This is like the story of the prodigal son, only I'm living it.
Honestly, Bree, I could die right now, and it would be perfectly fine by me.
Not by me, I said.
And not by me either,
my father said, coming up behind her, bending down, and kissing her on the cheek. Nana Mama usually made a fuss over public displays of affection, but she put her hand on her son's cheek and closed her eyes. And I had a flash of her when she must have been very young and holding her newborn child in her arms. My dad's cell phone buzzed. He stood up, dug it out, and read a text. He looked at me and then at my grandmother.
I'm afraid I haven't told you all of it, he said. How I came to be Peter Drummond and all.
That was true. He'd been very evasive about that part of his life.
You going to tell us? Nana Mama said.
In a minute, he said. First, there's someone I want you all to meet.
Chapter 102. My father came back, holding hands with Reverend Alicia Maya, who looked absolutely radiant in the last full rays of sunshine.
Alex, my dad said. Mom, I'd like to introduce you to my best friend, the woman whose love saved me. My wife, Alicia.
For the umpteenth time in the last 2 weeks, I got tears in my eyes. I'm so sorry I had to lie to you that day in the cemetery, Reverend Maya said, coming to me and holding my hands. But your dad thought that things would be better for you if you just went on believing he was dead. He considered his chance to see you a gift from God, and he said that was enough for him. But after you'd left Florida, he realized it wasn't enough. He wanted to know you, to be a part of your life. To do that, he'd had to come back and face Belle and destroy the life he'd made for himself. The story came out from the two of them as the day ebbed toward twilight, and everybody at the party stopped to listen. Reverend Maya found my father just the way she told me, weak, homeless, and limping into her church one day. She'd allowed him to sleep there. She'd provided him with counseling and helped him battle his addictions.
Through Alicia, I found God and have been sober for 34 years, my father said.
I was guilty of abandoning you boys, and you, Mom, but I was terrified of what might happen to me and to all of you if I ever returned to Starksville.
Reverend Maya said, he confessed it all to me one night about a year after he started living in the church. He told me about seeing Marvin Bell kill your mom, about being arrested and shot, surviving the gorge, recovering with the help of his beloved Clifford.
I told him I believed that God would forgive him. Is that when you fell in love with him? Nana Mama asked. No, love came later, after the war, when I realized how close I'd come to losing him. The night my father met Alicia Maya, he had fake papers that identified him as Paul Brown. But shortly after he confessed to the Reverend his true identity, a tragic miracle occurred. A 19-year-old named Peter Drummond came into the Reverend Maya's church, seeking counsel, just as my father had a year before. Drummond told her that he was an orphan and had been out of foster care in Kansas City for less than a year. He'd been homeless, and so on a whim, he'd enlisted in the Marine Corps. He said he'd made a mistake, Reverend Maya said, that he never should have enlisted and that he knew he was incapable of handling the pressures of war, especially of killing other men. She paused, and my father put his hand on his second wife's shoulder, said, "You couldn't have known." "I know," she sighed. Turns out he was in far deeper psychological and spiritual pain than I'd sensed. I told him to pray about it and trust that God would show him the right. She choked up. My father said, "Drummond went out in back of the church and shot himself in the face with a shotgun." "Jesus," Pinky said. "We were the only ones who heard the shot," Reverend Maya said. "I was hysterical when your father and I found him. She told me to call the police, and I didn't dare because I was scared," my father said. "Then I started going through his pockets, and there was his ID and his enlistment papers that said he had to be at Camp Lejeune in 2 days. "You switched papers," Ali said. "Very good, young man," my father said. "Alicia wanted no part of it at first, but I showed her that for me, it could be a total rebirth and a chance to do something hard and good for the first time in my life." "No one questioned the papers?" Bree asked. "Both ID photographs weren't the best, and he'd shot himself in the face," Reverend Maya said. "The police in Pahokee never questioned that the dead man was Paul Brown." "And the Marines were glad to have me," my father said. "I made corporal and went to Kuwait during the Gulf War. I was part of a crew that was supposed to seize and protect the oil wells that the Iraqis set on fire as they retreated. One blew, and I was too close." Reverend Maya said she and my father had kept in contact, writing letters back and forth before the explosion. She said, "When I saw him lying there at the VA hospital, I don't know, I just knew that I loved him, and I couldn't live without him ever again." "I felt the same way," my dad said. "You don't know what it did to my heart when she came in to see me." "And then you became a cop," I said. "I'd been a criminal," he replied. "I figured I'd be good at catching them." "He's good at it," Reverend Maya said. "But when he found out that you'd gone into the same field, Alex, he was beside himself with pride. He's followed your career every step of the way." "And you bump into each other in Belle Glade, Florida," Nana Mama said. "What are the odds of that happening?" Janie asked. "Astronomical," Reverend Maya said. "That's why I believe we were guided by a divine hand." "You believe that?" Nana Mama asked. "I do," she said. "I do," my father said. "I do too," I said. "How else do you explain it?" Nana Mama said, and she smiled. We all fell into a reflective quiet that had me wondering about the mystery that had been my life and how perfectly complete I felt at that moment. "I'd like to make a toast," my dad said, "so everyone get a glass." By the time we'd all gotten glasses and gathered together again, fireflies were flashing in the pines. My dad raised his ginger ale and said, "To our extended family and all our friends, living, dead, and now living again, may God bless the crosses." "Amen," Nana Mama said, and we all echoed her. Amen.
Continue listening to hear an excerpt from James Patterson's Private Paris. First arrondissement, April 6th, 3:30 p.m. The secret to understanding Parisians, Jack, is to see that they are almost the exact opposite of people in Los Angeles, said the big bear of a man sitting across from me. In L.A., children are raised to be optimistic, full of life, friendly. People who grow up in Paris, however, are taught the value of melancholy and an unwavering belief in the superiority of suffering. It's why they have a reputation for being rude. It's to make you as uncomfortable as they are. And they honestly believe they are doing you a favor. It was late afternoon, a warm, gorgeous spring day in the French capital, and Louis Langlois and I were sitting outside Taverne Henri Quatre in the Place Dauphine, well into our second glasses of excellent Bordeaux. I smiled and said, "It can't be that bad." Amused, Louis shook his head and said, "It is a fact that having fun, laughing, and generally enjoying life in Paris is a clear indication of latent insanity. Or at least that you are visiting from an inferior place, which means anywhere outside the city limits." "Come on," I said, chuckling now. "People seem genuinely nice. Even the waiters have been great so far." With a dismissive flip of his hand, he said, "They seem nice because at long last they understand that Paris is the number one tourist destination in the world, and that tourism is the biggest moneymaker in the city. At the same time, they know you are a tourist from America, the land of the absurdly obese, the absurdly wealthy, and the absurdly ignorant, and they hope you give them an absurdly big tip. You must believe me, Jack. Deep inside, Parisians are not enjoying themselves, and find it upsetting when others appear overly happy." I raised my eyebrows skeptically. "Don't believe me?" he said. "Watch." Louis threw back his head and began roaring with laughter. The laugh seemed to seize control of him and shook down through his entire body as if he were scratching his back with it. To my surprise and amusement, the patrons around us, and even the waitress who just delivered our wine, were now glancing sidelong at him. That only encouraged Louis, who started howling and slapping his thigh so hard tears streamed down his face. I couldn't help it and started laughing too. The people around us were gaping openly or sniffing at us now, as if we were refugees from a funny farm. At last, Louis calmed down and wiped away the tears, and when the cafe had returned to normalcy, he murmured, "What did I tell you? I use this laughter to upset suspects many times. To the people of Paris, a policeman who sees humor in everything, he must be crazy. He must be dangerous. He must be feared." I held up my hands in surrender. "Your city, Louis. My adopted city," he said, holding up a finger. "I do not think this way, but I understand it well." 30 years ago, Louis left his home in Nice in the south of France and joined the French National Police. His extraordinary emotional intelligence, his understanding of the French people, and his unorthodox investigative instincts had propelled him swiftly into a job in Paris with La Crime, an elite investigative force similar to the major case units of the New York and LA police departments. For 29 years, Louis served with distinction at La Crime. The day before his retirement, I offered him a job at three times his old pay. He now ran the Paris office of Private, a global security and investigative agency I founded and own. You'll hear people refer to Private as the Pinkertons of the 21st century. I don't know if we warrant that high praise, but it's flattering, and the reputation has helped us grow by leaps and bounds over the last few years, especially overseas, which causes me to travel more than I'd like. I'd been visiting the Berlin office for a few days and arrived in Paris the evening before. After a series of meetings with the local staff during the day, Louis suggested we go out for a few drinks and then a fine meal. That brilliant idea had brought us to one of his favorite cafes and led him to begin to explain to me the intricate mysteries of Paris, its citizens, and their way of thinking. Before Louis could move on to another subject, his cell phone rang. He frowned and said, "I asked them not to call me unless it was important." "No worries," I said, and took another sip of wine. Even if the Parisians weren't happy, I was. Louis Langlois was a funny guy, and Paris was still one of the most beautiful cities on earth, filled with interesting and sometimes shocking people, art, and food. In an hour or two, I'd no doubt be eating an incredible meal, and probably laughing a whole lot more. Life, for the foreseeable future, looked very good. And then it didn't. Louis listened to his phone, nodded, and said, "Of course I remember you, Monsieur Wilkerson. How can Private Paris be of help?" "Wilkerson?" The only Wilkerson I knew was a client who lived in Malibu. I mouthed, "Sherman Wilkerson?" Louis nodded and said into the phone, "Would you rather talk with Jack Morgan? He's right here." He handed me the phone. Now, the last time I'd heard from Sherman Wilkerson like this, out of the blue, there were four dead bodies on the beach below his house. I admit there were nerves in my voice when I said, "Sherman? What are you doing in Paris, Jack?" Wilkerson demanded. "Visiting one of my fastest-growing offices?" Sherman Wilkerson was a no-nonsense engineer who'd built a wildly successful industrial design company. By nature, he dealt with facts and often understated his opinion of things. So I was surprised when he said in a shaky voice, "Maybe there is a God after all." "You've got a problem in Paris?" I asked. "My only granddaughter, Kimberly. Kimberly Kupchinski," Wilkerson replied. "I just got off the phone with her. First call in more than 2 years. She's in an apartment outside Paris and says there are drug dealers hunting for her, trying to kill her. She sounded petrified and begged me to send someone to save her. Then the line went dead, and now I can't reach her." "Can you go make sure she's safe? I've got the address." "Of course," I said, signaling to Louis to pay the bill. "How do we find her?" Wilkerson read me out an address. I wrote it down and said, "Can you text me a photograph? And tell me about her. College student? Businesswoman?" Louis laid down cash on the table and gave me the thumbs up during a long pause. "Sherman?" I said, standing. "Are you there?" "I honestly don't know what Kim's been doing the past 2 years, and I know little of her life over the past five," Wilkerson admitted as we left the cafe and Louis called for a car. "Her parents, my daughter Pam and her husband Tim, they died in a boating accident 6 years ago." "I remember you telling me that," I said. "Sad." "Very. Kim was in her senior year at USC and back from a junior year in France when it happened. She was as devastated as we were. Long story short, she inherited a bit of money along with a trust and turned wild child. She barely graduated. When she did, she went straight back to France. For a time, I know she was working for the Cannes Film Festival organizers. We tried to stay in touch, but we heard from her less and less. Before today, there was a Christmas card from Monaco, and before that, a condolence card when my wife died." The car pulled up. Louis opened the door, and I climbed in, saying, "Don't worry, Sherman. We're on our way." "Thank you, Jack. You'll call when you have her?" "I will. Protect her, Jack. I beg you," Wilkerson said. "She's my only grandchild. My only living relative, really." "You've got nothing to worry about," I said, and hung up. After filling Louis in on the conversation, I handed him the napkin on which I'd written the address. "Know it?" Louis put his reading glasses on and studied it, and his nostrils flared as if he'd scented something foul. Then he looked up at me, and with a definite edge in his voice said, "Look up trouble and danger in a French dictionary, and you get a picture of this place." Montfermeil, eastern suburbs of Paris, 4:45 p.m. Shortly after Louis Langlois and I spoke with Sherman Wilkerson, we headed east out of Paris in workmen's blue jumpsuits that featured the logo of a bogus plumbing company. Louis drove a Mia electric-powered delivery vehicle, which looked like a minivan back home, only much smaller. The tiny van had the same fake plumbing logo painted on the rear panels and back door. Louis said he used the Mia and the plumbing disguises often during surveillance jobs, but tonight, we were using them to stay alive. The areas around the Bondi Forest have always been places of poverty, crime, and violence, Louis explained. You've read Les Miserables? Years ago, I said, but I saw the movie recently. Okay, he said. That scene where Jean Valjean meets Cosette getting water? The inn where the Thénardier robbed their customers? All in Montfermeil. It looks different today, of course, but the dark spirit of the place continues. Montfermeil is like your Bronx was in the 1970s, or South Central LA in the 90s. High unemployment, high crime rate, and lots of gangs, drug dealers, and violence. Add an angry Muslim and young immigrant population, and it's unimaginable to me why Mademoiselle Kopchinsky would take refuge in Les Bousquets, one of the worst housing projects in France. I shrugged. We'll find out, I guess. You sure about the plumber's gear being the right way to go? Bien sûr. Everybody needs the plumber at some time in some emergency, no? Plumbers can come and go at all hours, and no one thinks anything of it other than some poor bastard has a backed-up toilet. And plumbers tend not to get hassled, even in places like Les Bosquets. Why is that? Because everyone needs the plumber. Someone shakes the plumber down, and soon no plumbers will come. And no one wants that. Not even there. And this wouldn't fly in the States, I said, gesturing at the full jumpsuit. People would know we weren't plumbers. Louis seemed taken aback by that. How would they know? No American plumber would wear a coverall like this. If they did, they couldn't show their ass crack, and that's a requirement in the States. Louis glanced and then laughed. This is true? No. My cell phone buzzed, alerting me to a text. It was from Sherman Wilkerson, and included a photograph of a pretty young woman with sad eyes sitting at a bar. At a red light, I showed it to Langlois, saying, it's the most recent picture of her Sherman's God. He said it's at least 4 years old. As a rule, I don't like babysitting jobs, Langlois said. Neither do I agreed, pocketing the phone. But when a client like Sherman asks private to look after his granddaughter, we answer. 20 minutes later, and less than 11 miles from the chic streets and genteel parks of central Paris, we entered a world apart. Out the van's window, the area didn't look too bad at night. It kind of reminded me of East Berlin, with big clusters of drab, uniform, state-designed high-rise apartment buildings, a communist's decaying vision of ideal housing. Then I started seeing the graffiti. Fuck the police was a common theme. So were images of faceless men in dark hoods with flames painted behind them and Arabic scrawled above them. Was this project part of those riots a few years back? I asked. Les Bosquets was in the thick of it, Louis confirmed. And it's home to a vicious gang that specializes in targeting tourists who take the train from De Gaulle to Paris. A few months ago, they put a car on the tracks to stop a train holding more than 100 Japanese visitors. Then they went on board, robbed everyone at gunpoint. Brazen. Yes, but there are reasons, Louis replied. Back in the 60s and 70s, when France was on the up economically, we needed labor. So they allowed anyone from a current or foreign French colony to immigrate here. They built the projects, and a generation later, the economy busts and the immigrants stay on, having children. Lots of children. 50% of the population out here is younger than 25, and they can't find jobs. So they live in terrible conditions with no purpose. It's a recipe for disaster for everyone involved. Can't they work their way out of it through school? I asked. Louis wagged a finger at me and said,
You are thinking of the States again, Jacques. In France, it is not the same. There are proven paths to power here. The right schools, the right friends, and these paths are shut off to the immigrants.
Worse, there's no public transportation in these areas. Without a car, you go nowhere. You're trapped. You get angry. You explode. Louis flicked his chin toward the windshield. There it is. Les Bosquets. The project consisted of 8 decaying high-rise apartment buildings. Clotheslines hung from windows, as did immigrants of all ages and skin colors. Louis pulled over on the Avenue Clichy-sous-Bois. He opened the glove compartment,
got out a Glock 19 and handed it to me. "I'm not licensed to carry this in France," I said.
"You're not a licensed French plumber either, Jack," Louis said. "Put it in your pocket and let me do the talking."
It's hard to argue with a guy who knows his turf as well as Louis. I decided to trust his judgment and nodded. We got out and grabbed toolboxes and flashlights from the rear hatchback. Men across the street had checked us out when we pulled up, but now they were ignoring us.
"You see?"
Louis muttered as we headed down the road that ran north into the complex.
"Everyone needs us, even if we don't show the butt cracks."
5:15 p.m. Louis was right about plumber being the perfect disguise. We passed four or five small groups of menacing-looking types, and as soon as they'd had a hard stare at our plumber's logo, they relaxed and looked away. The last group was out in front of the entrance to the address we'd been given, a building at the rear of Les Bosquets. I remembered enough from high school French class to understand when one of the guys asked where we were going. Louis never broke stride, just went past him saying something I couldn't follow. It seemed to do the trick, however, because no one trailed us into the lobby, which featured poor lighting, a wall of mailboxes, many broken, and a cement floor that was cracked and offset in several places.
"What did you tell those guys?"
I asked.
"I said that the toilet in 412 was backed up, and there's shit all over the place. It shuts down their curiosity every time."
We didn't have to use a buzzer because there was no buzzer or security of any kind. A young Muslim woman in black robes and headscarf came down the stairs and glanced at us with enormous brown eyes that showed suspicion until they focused on the logos on our jumpsuits. She nodded and went on. Two Asian teenagers came bouncing down the stairs as we climbed and never gave us a second glance, nor did the African woman carrying a load of laundry.
"I've got to remember this," I muttered to Louis as I followed him toward a cement staircase.
"Plumbing is a beautiful thing," he replied.
When we reached the fourth floor of the tenement, we opened the door into an empty hallway with a rug frayed down to the floorboards. The smells of the place hit me all at once. Lamb cooking in garlic and onions, cigarette smoke, marijuana smoke, and the odor of too many people living in tight quarters. The apartment walls and doors could not have been very thick or insulated, because a general din filled the passage. Babies crying, pots banging, men shouting, women shouting back, televisions and music blaring in Arabic and other languages I couldn't identify. It all felt depressing, suffocating even, and I'd been in the building less than 3 minutes. Louis said there were people who lived in Les Bosquets their entire lives, and I began to understand some of the pressures that contributed to the riots. But why had Wilkerson's granddaughter come here, of all places? Louis knocked on the door to 412. Several moments later, a woman's voice asked who we were, and Louis replied that we were from private and had been sent by Kim's grandfather. A minute passed before a deadbolt was thrown. The door opened on a chain, and a wary woman who looked Polynesian and was wearing a blue skirt and floral blouse looked out at us and asked to see our identification. We showed it to her, and she shut the door. Nothing happened for several minutes, and Louis was about to knock again when we heard the chain slide and the door opened. Louis stepped inside a dimly lit, narrow hallway, and I followed. The door shut behind us, and I turned to find myself face to face with Kimberly Kopchinski. In her late 20s now, wearing jeans, a black blouse, and a rectangular silver thing on a chain around her neck. She was undeniably beautiful in person. But I could tell by the color of her skin and the way she held herself that she'd been through some terrible physical ordeal recently, and that she was very, very frightened. We introduced ourselves and showed her the badges and identifications. "How do I know my grandfather sent you?" she asked. I showed her Sherman's text and the picture of her. Kim stared at the picture for several moments as if she barely remembered the girl in it. "He says you're in danger," I said.
"I am in danger," she said.
"He said something about drug dealers?"
"I just need somewhere to go," to disappear for a while, she said in a strained whisper. Can you help me do that?
We can, I replied, but it helps if we know who we're hiding you from, Kimberly.
Her face twisted with inner pain, and she said, call me Kim. And can we have this conversation later? Once I'm somewhere safe, I can't stay here anymore. My friend's husband is coming home from Lyon in a few hours. He doesn't know I'm here, and if he did, I'd be... Her lower lip quivered.
Don't worry, Miss Kopchinsky, Louis said. You are under the care and protection of Private Paris now. Already you could not be safer. We'll take you to the same hotel where Jacques is staying.
A hotel? Kim said, alarmed. No, that's too public.
Louis said soothingly, this hotel is the most discreet in Paris. Already I have you registered there under an alias. The Polynesian woman emerged from a doorway at the other end of the hall carrying a canvas bag. She set it down and tapped on her watch. Kim appeared to be torn, but nodded and went to the woman. She talked quietly to her for several moments before hugging her. Both women looked distraught when they parted. Grabbing the bag, Kim said, let's go. We got more scrutiny leaving with her than we had when entering, and plenty of hostile glances, but no one challenged us directly. With Kim in the back seat and Louis starting the Mia, I thought we were home free. 30 minutes from now, we'd have her safely in a suite at the Plaza Athénée, and I'd be talking to Sherman Wilkerson, trying to figure out a way to get her quickly to L.A. Louis threw the Mia in gear and was pulling a U-turn to head west toward Paris when headlights went on a block in front of us. Another set went on half a block behind us. I didn't think much of it until the car in front of us, a black Renault, pulled out and stopped sideways across the street. He couldn't block the entire avenue, but there wasn't a whole lot of room to get past him either.
Merde,
Louis said, locking up the brakes on the electric van and throwing us in reverse. What's happening? Kim cried.
We're not waiting to find out, I said, twisting around in the seat to look out the rear window and see the other car, a blue Peugeot coming fast in the other lane. A bald, pale man in a studded red leather jacket hung out the passenger side window. He was aiming a rotary magazine shotgun.
This has been a Hachette audio production of Cross Justice, written by James Patterson, read by Ruben Santiago Hudson and Jefferson Mays, produced and directed by Kevin Thompson, recorded by Molly Thompson, post-production by Merlin Music, New York City. Cross Justice is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2015 by James Patterson. Audio production copyright 2015, Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. And any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.